Work began on May 15, 1945, and took 2 weeks to complete. The analysis revealed that Tabin was a revolutionary killer that could decimate enemy armies. General William N. Porter, chief of the Chemical Warfare Service, requested that 5 260-kilogram Tabin-filled bombs be shipped from the robber's lair to the United States by air under highest priority for field tests. Separately, General Porter asked the U.S. Army Air Forces and U.S. Army Ordnance to conduct their own feasibility studies to determine if Tabin bombs could be used in combat by U.S. troops. Most people looked upon chemical warfare as abhorrent. In a June 1943 speech, President Roosevelt himself had said that using chemicals to kill people was immoral and inhumane. The president had denied Chemical Warfare Service officials their request to change the service's name to the Chemical Corps because of the permanence the name change suggested. And yet here was the interesting news for the Chemical Service. When German nerve gas entered into the world of chemical warfare, it brought with it the assurance of a U.S. chemical warfare program in peacetime. According to chemical weapons expert Jonathan B. Tucker, in 1945, in the aftermath of World War II, the U.S. Army Chemical Warfare Service decided to focus its research and development efforts on the German nerve agents, the technological challenges of which promised to ensure the organization's survival through the period of post-war demobilization and declining military budgets. Within several months of the German surrender, 530 tons of Tabin nerve agent were shipped to the United States and used in top-secret field tests. Requests to bring German chemists to the United States for weapons work quickly followed. But, as had been the case with the V-2 rocket scientists, the notion of issuing visas to Hitler's chemists was met with hostility inside the State Department. When the chief of the State Department's Passport Division, Howard K. Travers, learned about this idea, he sent his colleagues an internal memo stating, "We should do everything we consistently can to prevent German chemists and others from entering this country." In Germany, Alsace scientific director Samuel Goudsmit had been tracking Hitler's chemists ever since the Allies crossed the Rhine. Likewise, the SIOS chemical weapons team, led by Lieutenant Colonel Philip R. Tarr of the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service, and his British counterpart, Major Edmund Tilley, were continuing their relentless pursuit. When Alsace located the chemist Richard Kuhn at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Medical Research in Heidelberg, they paid him a visit. Kuhn had once been an internationally revered organic chemist, but rumor had it that he had become an ardent Nazi during the war. Kuhn won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1938, but turned down accepting the award at the request of Hitler, who called it a Jewish prize. Here now to interview Richard Kuhn, Samuel Goudsmit had with him two American chemists, Louis Fieser of Harvard and Carl Baumann of the University of Wisconsin. Both men had actually worked with Kuhn in his laboratory before the war. After a cordial exchange of greetings, the interrogation began. Alsace sought information regarding the Third Reich's nerve agent program. What did Herr Kuhn know? Kuhn, with his mop of straight reddish-brown hair, cunning smile, and schoolboy looks, swore that he had no connection whatsoever with Reich military research. He told his former colleagues that he was a pure scientist, an academic who spent the war working on the chemistry of modern drugs. Samuel Goudsmit had his doubts. "Richard Kuhn's record did not seem too clean to me," Goudsmit recalled after the war. As president of the German Chemical Society, he had followed the Nazi cult and rites quite faithfully. He never failed to give the Hitler salute when starting his classes and to shout "Sieg Heil" like a true Nazi leader, Goudsmit recalled. But the Alsace leader did not have enough evidence to have Kuhn arrested, so he put him under surveillance instead. Elsewhere in Germany, SIOS chemical weapons investigators Colonel Tarr and Major Tilly had been rounding up German chemists and sending them to prisoner of war facilities near where the individual arrests had taken place. Starting on June 1, 1945, these chemists would now be sent to a single location, a top-secret interrogation facility outside Frankfurt. SCHAEF was moving its headquarters from Versailles to Frankfurt and was to be dissolved in mid-July. The new organization, in charge of all affairs, including scientific exploitation, was the Office of Military Government for Germany, OMGUS, whose commander was Eisenhower's deputy, General Lucius D. Clay. The Allies were also reorganizing the way in which scientific intelligence was going to be collected moving forward. SIOS was transitioning into American and British components, FIAT, Field Information Agency, Technical, and BIOS, British Intelligence Objectives Subcommittee. SIOS teams would remain active while they completed open investigations. The structure that housed this new interrogation center was none other than Schloss Kranzberg, or Kranzberg Castle, Hermann Göring's former Luftwaffe headquarters and the place where Albert Speer and his aide spent the night the last New Year's Eve of the war. The Allies gave it the code name Dustbin. This medieval structure, built high in the Taunus Mountains, had grand rooms, hardwood floors, beautiful stone fireplaces, and shiny chandeliers. These were hardly gulag-type quarters. In terms of security classification, Dustbin was top tier. The facility was the second most classified interrogation center after Ashcan. Dustbin was self-contained inside its centuries-old stone walls, and, as it went at Ashcan, the prisoners here were free to roam the grounds and chat among themselves. Karl Brandt, Hitler's doctor, organized morning gymnastics classes in the garden. Others played chess. Industrialists held lectures in the large banquet hall that Göring had once used as a casino. Speer took walks in the castle's apple orchard, almost always alone by choice. Whereas Ashcan housed the Nazi high command, Dustbin had many Nazi scientists, doctors, and industrialists under guard. This included more than 20 chemists with IG Farben and at least 6 members of its board. Throughout the early summer of 1945, several key players in Farben's Tab and Gas program were still at large. For Major Tilly, the chronology regarding how Farben first began producing nerve gas and how it transformed into wide-scale production remained a mystery until a Farben chemist named Dr. Gerhard Schroeder was captured and brought to Dustbin. Schroeder was the man who created the nerve agent that had been found at Raubkammer, the robber's lair. The information Schroeder had was among the most sought-after classified military intelligence in the world. Tilly prepared for intense stonewalling from the Farben chemist. Instead, Dr. Schroeder spoke freely, offering up everything he knew, beginning with Tauben's startling discovery in the fall of 1936. Dr. Schroeder had been working at an insecticide lab for IG Farben in Leverkusen, north of Cologne, for several years. By the fall of 1936, he had an important job on his hands. Weevils and leaf lice were destroying grain across Germany, and Schroeder was tasked with creating a synthetic pesticide that could eradicate these tiny pests. The government had been spending 30 million Reichsmarks a year on pesticides made by Farben as well as other companies. IG Farben wanted to develop an insect killer that could save money for the Reich and earn the company a monopoly on pesticides. Synthesizing organic, carbon-based compounds was trial-and-error work, Dr. Schroeder told Major Tilly. It was labor-intensive and dangerous. Schroeder, a family man, took excellent precautions against exposure, always working under a fume hood. Even trace amounts of the chemicals he was using had cumulative, potentially lethal effects. Trotter suffered from frequent headaches and sometimes felt short of breath. One night, while driving home after working on a new product, Trotter could barely see the road in front of him. When he pulled over to examine his eyes in the mirror, he saw that his pupils had constricted to the size of a pinhead. Over the next several days, his vision grew worse. He developed a throbbing pressure in his larynx. Finally, Trotter checked himself into a hospital, where he was monitored for 2 weeks before being sent home and told to rest. 8 days after the respite, Trotter returned to work. He had been developing a cyanide-containing fumigant, which he had given the code name Preparation 991. Picking up where he'd left off with his work, he prepared a small amount of his new substance, diluting it to 1 in 200,000 units to see if it would kill lice clinging to leaves. He was stunned when his new creation killed 100% of the lice. Trotter repeated the experiment for his colleagues. They all agreed that Preparation 991 was 100 times more lethal than anything anyone at the Leverkusen lab had ever worked with before. Dr. Trotter sent a sample of this lethal new fumigant to Farben's Director of Industrial Hygiene, a man named Professor Eberhard Gross, not to be confused with Dr. Karl Gross, the Waffen-SS bacteriologist connected with the Gerberg discovery. Gross tested the substance on apes and was duly shocked by the results. After a healthy ape was injected with a tiny amount of Preparation 991, just 1/10 of a milligram per kilo of body weight, the ape died in less than an hour. Next, Gross tested the substance on an ape inside an inhalation chamber. He watched this healthy ape die in 16 minutes. Professor Gross told Dr. Trotter that his Preparation 991 was being sent to Berlin and that he should wait for further instructions on what action to take next. At Dustbin, Trotter told Major Tilly that when he learned his compound could kill a healthy ape through airborne contact in minutes, he became upset. His discovery was never going to be used as an insecticide, Trotter lamented. It was simply too dangerous for any warm-blooded animal or human to come into contact with. Trotter said his goal was to save money for the Reich. With the news of how powerful Preparation 991 was, Trotter felt he'd failed at his job. He got back to work, searching for a fumigant better suited for the task of killing weevils and leaf lice. Meanwhile, Professor Gross brought the substance to his superiors. Starting in 1935, a Reich ordinance required all new discoveries with potential military application to be reported to the War Office. The Reich's Chemical Weapons Department began to evaluate Trotter's Preparation 991 for its potential use in chemical warfare. In May 1937, Trotter was invited to Berlin to demonstrate how he'd synthesized Preparation 991. Everyone was astounded, Trotter told Tilly. This was the most promising chemical killer since the Germans invented mustard gas. Preparation 991 was classified top secret and given a code name, Taban gas. It came from the English word taboo, something prohibited or forbidden. Dr. Trotter was told to produce 1 kilogram for the German army, which would take over Taban production on a massive scale. Trotter got a bonus of 50,000 Reichsmarks. The average German worker during this time period earned 3,100 Reichsmarks a year, and was told to get back to work. Farben still needed him to develop a lice-killing insecticide. With their new nerve agent, Taban, Farben executives saw all kinds of business opportunities. Karl Krau, the head of Farben's board of directors, began working with Hermann Göring on a longer-range plan to arm Germany with chemical weapons, ones that could eventually be dropped on the enemy from airplanes. In his report to Göring, Krau called Taban the weapon of superior intelligence and superior scientific technological thinking. The beauty in the nerve agent, Krau told Göring, was that it could be used against the enemy's hinterland. Göring agreed, adding that what he liked most about chemical weapons was that they terrified people. He responded to Krau in writing, noting that the deadly effects of nerve agents like tabin gas could wreak psychological havoc on civilian populations, driving them crazy with fear. On August 22, 1938, Göring named Karl Krau his plenipotentiary for special questions of chemical production. Farben was now positioned to build the Reich's chemical weapons industry from the ground up. The Treaty of Versailles had forced Germany to destroy all of its chemical weapons factories after World War I, which meant factories had to be secretly built. This was an enormous undertaking, now an official part of the Nazis' secret four-year plan, and through Krau, IG Farben was made privy to the Reich's war plan before war was declared. At the Dustbin Interrogation Center, Major Tilly asked Schroeder about full-scale production. Based on the Allies' discovery of thousands of tons of tabin bombs in the forest outside Raubkammer, Farben must have had an enormous secret production facility somewhere. Dr. Schroeder said that he was not involved in full-scale production. That was the job of his colleague, Dr. Otto Ambrose. Major Tilly asked Schroeder to tell him more about Ambrose. Schroeder said that most of what Ambrose did was classified, but that if Major Tilly wanted to know more about what he actually did for Farben, Tilly should talk to individuals who sat on Farben's board of directors with Ambrose, either Dr. Karl Krau or Baron Georg von Schnitzler. Both men were interned here at Dustbin. "Who is Mr. Ambrose?" Major Tilly asked Baron Georg von Schnitzler in an interview that would later be presented as evidence in a Nuremberg war crimes trial. "He is one of our first younger technicians," von Schnitzler said. "He was in charge of Düsseldorf, as well as Auschwitz and Gindorf." "Where was Ambrose now?" Tilly asked von Schnitzler. The Baron told Major Tilly to talk to Karl Krau. From Krau, Major Tilly learned quite a bit more about Ambrose. That he had been in charge of technical development of chemical weapons production at Gindorf and at Düsseldorf. That Gindorf produced mustard gas on an industrial scale, and that Düsseldorf produced tabin. Krau also revealed a new piece of evidence. Düsseldorf produced a second nerve agent, one that was even more potent than tabin, called sarin. Sarin was an acronym pieced together from the names of four key persons involved in its development: Schroeder and Ambrose from IG Farben, and from the German army, two officers named Rüdiger and Lind. Krau told Major Tilly that the Düsseldorf plant had fallen into Russian hands. Karl Krau said something else that caught Major Tilly by surprise. Before coming to Dustbin, Krau said he had been in the hospital, where he'd been paid a visit by two American officers, one of whom was Lieutenant Colonel Tarr. "Judging from conversations I had a few months ago in the hospital with members of the USSBS, Colonel Snow, and Chemical Warfare, Colonel Tarr," Krau explained, "the gentlemen seemed mostly interested in sarin and tabin. They asked me for construction plans and details of fabrication. As far as I understood, they intended to erect similar plants in the USA. I told them to apply to Dr. Ambrose and his staff at Gindorf." Major Tilly was shocked. Lieutenant Colonel Tarr was his SIOS partner, and yet Tarr had neglected to share with him the story about visiting Krau in the hospital. This was Tilly's first indication that Tarr was running a separate mission for the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service, one that apparently had a different objective than the SIOS mission. The full, dramatic story was about to unfold. By June 1945, Otto Ambrose had been questioned by soldiers with the Third Army numerous times. For reasons that remain obscure, no one from that division had been informed of the fact that Ambrose was wanted for war crimes, or that he had served as Farben's chief of chemical weapons production throughout Hitler's rule. To the Third Army, he was simply the plain chemist in the Bavarian village of Gindorf, the smiling, well-dressed businessman who supplied American soldiers with free bars of soap. At Dustbin, Major Tilly relayed this critical new information about Dr. Otto Ambrose to his Fiat superiors, who in turn sent an urgent message to the 6th Army Group, also in Gindorf, ordering the immediate arrest of Dr. Ambrose. The 6th Army was to transport Ambrose directly to Dustbin so that Major Tilly could interrogate him. A note card was placed in Ambrose's dossier. Disparate bits of information were now coming into sharp focus. Case number 21877, Dr. Otto Ambrose, rumored to have been involved in use of concentration camp personnel for testing effectiveness of new poison gases developed at Gindorf. Crocas notified Schaeff, insisting that Dr. Ambrose be arrested. As the plant manager at Farben's Buna factory at Auschwitz, Otto Ambrose had been linked to atrocities, including mass murder and slavery. The 6th Army Group swung into action. But when they arrived at Ambrose's home in Gindorf, arrest orders in hand, Ambrose was gone. The first assumption was that Ambrose had fled on his own. This proved incorrect. He had been taken away by Lieutenant Colonel Philip Tarr. Initially, the commanding officer at Dustbin found this impossible to comprehend. It was one thing for Tarr to try to interview Ambrose before any other chemical warfare experts did. That kind of rivalry had been going on ever since the various scientific intelligence teams had crossed the Rhine. But why would Tarr defy orders from Schaeff to have Ambrose arrested? While soldiers with the 6th Army stood scratching their heads in Gindorf, Tarr and Ambrose were actually headed to Heidelberg in a U.S. Army jeep. Their destination was an American interrogation center that was run by Army intelligence officers with the Chemical Warfare Service. For days, no one at Dustbin had any idea where Tarr and Ambrose had gone. Otto Ambrose had a razor-sharp mind. He was cunning and congenial, sly like a fox. He almost always wore a grin. The American war crimes prosecutor, Josiah Dubois, described him as having a devilish friendliness about him. He also had a distracting, rabbit-like habit of sniffing at the air. Ambrose was short and heavy-set, with white hair and flat feet. He was a brilliant scientist who studied chemistry and agronomy under Nobel Prize winner Richard Willstetter, a Jew. As a chemist, Ambrose had a mind that was capable of pushing science into realms previously unexplored. Few men were as important to IG Farben during the war as Otto Ambrose had been. IG Farben first began producing synthetic rubber in 1935, naming it Buna after its primary component, butadiene. In 1937, Farben presented commercial Buna on the world stage, and won the gold medal at the International Expo in Paris. When Germany invaded Poland in September 1939, the Reich's ability to import natural rubber diminished. Demand for a synthetic alternative skyrocketed, a fact Farben was well aware of in advance of Germany's attack. Tanks needed treads, aircraft needed tires, and Farben needed to produce rubber. Hitler directed Farben to increase its Buna production further. Dr. Ambrose was put in charge and saw to it that Farben opened a second and then a third Buna plant so that supply could meet demand. As the invasion of the Soviet Union was secretly conceived by the German High Command, Hitler again called upon Farben's board of directors to increase its synthetic rubber production. Farben needed to construct a massive new Buna factory. Otto Ambros was put in charge of masterminding this undertaking as well. The place chosen was Auschwitz. Once, Auschwitz was a regular town. Ordinary people lived there, and tourists visited to see the castle, the churches, the large medieval market square, and the synagogue, write historians Deborah Dwork and Robert Jan van Pelt. In the 1930s, visitors sent postcards from the area that read, "Greetings from Auschwitz." When, in the fall of 1940, Otto Ambros pored over maps of this region, called Upper Silesia, in search of a Buna factory site, he found what he was looking for. The production of synthetic rubber required four things: water, flat land, good railway connections, and an abundance of laborers. Auschwitz had all four. Three rivers met in Auschwitz, the Sola, the Vistula, and the Przemysl, with a water flow of 525,000 cubic feet per hour. The land was flat and 65 feet above the waterline, making it safe from floodwaters. The railway connections were sound. But most important was the labor issue. The concentration camp next door could provide an endless labor supply because the men were cheap and could be worked to death. For Farben, the use of slave labor could take the company to levels of economic prowess previously unexplored. First, a financial deal had to be made with the SS. Ambros was instrumental in this act. For months, before the building of the Buna factory got the go-ahead, the SS and Farben haggled over deal points. Some of the paperwork survived the war. On November 8, 1940, the Reich's Minister of Economics wrote to Farben's board of directors requesting that they hurry up and settle the question regarding the site. Otto Ambros lobbied hard for Auschwitz, and in December, IG Farben sent a busload of its rubber experts and construction workers to survey the worksite. A Farben employee named Eric Santo was assigned to serve as Otto Ambros's construction foreman. The concentration camp, already existing with approximately 7,000 prisoners, is to be expanded, Santo noted in his official company report. For Ambros, Farben's arrangement with the SS regarding slave laborers remained vague. Ambros sought clarity. It is therefore necessary to open negotiations with the Reich leader SS, Himmler, as soon as possible in order to discuss necessary measures with him, Ambros wrote in his official company report. The two men had a decades-old relationship. Heinrich Himmler and Otto Ambros had known one another since grade school. Ambros could make Himmler see eye to eye with him on the benefits that Auschwitz offered to both Farben and the SS. In fact, the SS and IG Farben needed one another. Himmler wanted Farben's resources at Auschwitz and was eager to make the deal to supply the slaves. So SS officers hosted a dinner party for Farben's rubber and construction experts at the Auschwitz concentration camp inside an SS banquet hall there. During the festivities, the remaining issues were finally agreed upon. Farben would pay the SS 3 Reichsmarks a day for each laborer they supplied, which would go into the SS treasury, not to the slaves. On the occasion of a dinner party given for us by the management of the concentration camp, we furthermore determined all the arrangements relating to the involvement of the really excellent concentration camp operation in support of the Buna plants, Ambros wrote to his boss, Fritz Termeer, on April 12, 1941. Our new friendship with the SS is proving very profitable, Ambros explained. The SS agreed to provide Farben with 1,000 slave workers immediately. That number, promised Himmler, could quickly rise to 30,000 with demand. The relationship between Farben and the SS at Auschwitz was now cemented. Otto Ambrose was the key to making the Buna factory a success. With his knowledge of synthetic rubber and his managerial experience, he also ran Farben's secret nerve gas production facilities. There was no better man than Otto Ambrose for the Auschwitz job. Major Tilly waited at Dustbin for the return of Tarr and Ambrose. It was now clear to him that there was no single individual more important to Hitler's chemical weapons program than Otto Ambrose had been. Ambrose was in charge of chemical weapons at Gindorf and Dürrenfort, and he was the manager of the Buna factory at Auschwitz. From interviewing various Farben chemists held at Dustbin, Tilly had also learned that the gas used to murder millions of people at Auschwitz and other concentration camps, Zyklon B, was a Farben product. Farben owned the patent on Zyklon B, and it was sold to the Reich by an IG Farben company. In one of these interviews, Tilly asked IG Farben board member Baron Georg von Schnitzler if Otto Ambrose knew that Farben chemicals were being used to murder people. You said yesterday that a Farben employee alluded to you that the poisonous gases and the chemicals manufactured by IG Farben were being used for the murder of human beings held in concentration camps, Major Tilly reminded von Schnitzler in their interview. So I understood him, von Schnitzler replied. Didn't you question those employees of yours further in regard to the use of these gases? They said they knew it was being used for this purpose, von Schnitzler said. What did you do when he told you that IG chemicals were being used to kill, to murder people held in concentration camps? Major Tilly asked. I was horrified, said von Schnitzler. Did you do anything about it? I kept it for me because it was too terrible, von Schnitzler confessed. I asked the Farben employee, is it known to you and Ambrose and the other directors in Auschwitz that the gases and chemicals are being used to murder people? What did he say? Asked Major Tilly. Yes, it is known to all the IG directors in Auschwitz, von Schnitzler said. For Lieutenant Colonel Philip R. Tarr, there was a mission at hand. Enemy Equipment Intelligence Service Team Number 1, which he served on, needed information that only Dr. Otto Ambrose had. Specifically, the team needed blueprints for equipment necessary for producing Tabin nerve gas. When Tarr and Ambrose arrived in Heidelberg, the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service had another IG Farben chemist in custody whom they wanted Ambrose to work with on a classified job. The man is referred to in documents only as Herr Stumpfe. Ambrose and Stumpfe were told to drive to a special metals firm located in Hanau, where they were to locate 30 or 40 drawings of silver-lined equipment. The Chemical Warfare Service trusted Ambrose to such a degree that they sent him and Stumpfe on this mission without an escort. Manufacturing Tabin gas was a precise and clandestine process. The United States desperately wanted to reproduce it, but attempting to do so without Farben's proprietary formula and its secret equipment was a potential death sentence for any chemist involved. Farben had spent millions of Reichsmarks on research and development. Hundreds of concentration camp workers had died in this trial-and-error process. When the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service learned that the silver-lined equipment used to manufacture Tabin gas on a large scale had been outsourced from a special metals firm called Heraus, they coveted those blueprints and plans. Dr. Ambrose and Herr Stumpfe were to go to this engineering firm to locate these drawings and blueprints and bring them back to Heidelberg. The Chemical Warfare Service agents could not conduct this mission on their own because they had no idea what equipment to look for. The two Farben chemists, Ambrose and Stumpfy, set off on their secret assignment. When they arrived at the factory in Hanau, personnel of a U.S. CIC, Counterintelligence Corps, group with headquarters at that time in Hanau arrested them, read a secret report. When they explained their mission, the CIC personnel concerned confirmed the German engineer's statement by communication with Heidelberg, and the two Germans were released. Ambrose and Stumpfy drove away. The CIC personnel, concerned after having learned of the drawings through the two German engineers, then seized the drawings and took them to their own headquarters, read a classified army report. The Chemical Warfare Service never obtained the drawings they were looking for. But at least Tarr had Dr. Ambrose under his control, or so he believed. Instead, somewhere between Ambrose's release from the Herraus engineering firm in Hanau and his return to Heidelberg, he was able to communicate to his network of spies and informants in Gindorf. From those sources, Ambrose learned that soldiers with the U.S. 6th Army had an order to arrest him. So instead of returning to Tarr's custody, Ambrose drove to a fancy guest house that IG Farben maintained outside Heidelberg called Villa Kohlhoff, where a staff of Farben employees tended to his every need. Sios and Fiat officials from Dustbin finally made contact with Tarr and ordered him to return with Ambrose to the interrogation facility immediately. But Tarr was no longer in control of Ambrose. Major Tilly went looking for Ambrose himself and found Hitler's chemist residing at Villa Kohlhoff. Ambrose told Major Tilly that he would agree to continue cooperating with the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service and the various Allied agencies that sought information from him, but only on one condition, that Tilly secure the release of all chemical warfare personnel already detained at Dustbin. This was a preposterous request. Tilly's superior, Major P.M. Wilson of Fiat's Enemy Personnel Exploitation Section, attempted to take control of the situation, ordering Ambrose brought to Dustbin immediately. This was not a matter of cooperation, Wilson said. There were orders to arrest the man. Lieutenant Colonel Tarr intervened on Ambrose's behalf. He lobbied the British Ministry of Supply, the agency responsible for British chemical warfare issues, for help getting Ambrose's Dustbin colleagues released. To Tarr, extracting Ambrose's esoteric knowledge outweighed the need to hold him accountable for his crimes. But the British also flatly refused to help Tarr. The matter stalled. Lieutenant Colonel Tarr flew to Paris. That night, a telegram arrived at Dustbin, sent from Paris and purporting to be from the British Ministry of Supply. The telegram ordered the release of all Farben chemical warfare scientists at Dustbin and was signed by a British Ministry of Supply colonel named J.T.M. Childs. Officers at Dustbin suspected that something was amiss and contacted Colonel Childs about his outrageous request. Colonel Childs swore he had neither written the memo nor signed it and accused Lieutenant Colonel Tarr of forgery. Fiat enhanced their efforts to have Dr. Ambrose arrested in Heidelberg. The efforts failed. Ambrose was able to evade capture by fleeing into the safety of the French zone. Double-crossing Lieutenant Colonel Tarr, Otto Ambrose struck a deal with French chemical weapons experts. In exchange for information, he was given a job as plant manager at Farben's chemical factory in Ludwigshafen. When Fiat officers at Dustbin learned what had happened, they were outraged. Ambrose's escape had been entirely preventable. It is evident that he was not kept in custody or under house arrest, noted Captain R.E.F. Edelston, a British officer with the Ministry of Supply. Major P.M. Wilson saw the situation in much darker terms. Lieutenant Colonel Tarr had taken steps to assist Ambrose to evade arrest, he wrote in a scathing report. Wilson was appalled by the friendly treatment being given to this man who is suspected of war criminality. But these were just words. Ambrose was now a free man, living and working in the French zone. The relationship among Tarr, Ambrose, and the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service was far from over. It was only a matter of time before an American chemical company would learn of the Army's interest in a whole new field of chemical weapons. An American chemist, Dr. Wilhelm Hirschkind, was in Germany at the same time. Dr. Hirschkind was conducting a survey of the German chemical industry for the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service while on temporary leave from the Dow Chemical Company. Dr. Hirschkind had spent several months inspecting IG Farben plants in the U.S. and British zones, and now he was in Heidelberg, hoping to meet Ambrose. Lieutenant Colonel Tarr reached out to Colonel Weiss, the French commander in charge of IG Farben's chemical plant in Ludwigshafen, and a meeting was arranged. On July 28, 1945, Dr. Hirschkind met with Dr. Ambrose and Lieutenant Colonel Tarr in Heidelberg. Ambrose brought his wartime deputy with him to the meeting, the Farben chemist, Jürgen von Klink. It was von Klink who, in the final months of the war, had helped Ambrose destroy evidence, hide documents, and disguise the Farben factory at Gindorf so that it appeared to produce soap, not chemical weapons. Jürgen von Klink was initially detained at Dustbin, but later released. The Heidelberg meetings lasted several days. When Dr. Wilhelm Hirschkind left, he had these words for Ambrose. I would look forward after the conclusion of the peace treaty to continuing our relations in my position as a representative of Dow. Only later did Fiat interrogators learn about this meeting. Major Tilly's suspicions were now confirmed. A group inside the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service, including his former partner, Lieutenant Colonel Tarr, did indeed have an ulterior motive that ran counter to the motives of SIOS, Fiat, and the United Nations War Crimes Commission. Tilly's superior at Dustbin, Major Wilson, confirmed this dark and disturbing truth in a classified military intelligence report on the Ambrose affair. It is believed that the conflict between Fiat and Lieutenant Colonel Tarr was due to the latter's wish to use Ambrose for industrial chemical purposes back in the United States. All documents regarding the Ambrose affair would remain classified for the next 40 years, until August of 1985. That an officer of the U.S. Chemical Warfare Service, Lieutenant Colonel Tarr, had sheltered a wanted war criminal from capture in the aftermath of the German surrender was damning. That this officer was also participating in meetings with the fugitive and a representative from the Dow Chemical Company was scandalous. In 1945, the Chemical Warfare Service was also in charge of the U.S. Biological Weapons Program, the existence of which remained secret from the American public. The program was robust. If the atomic bomb failed to end the war in Japan, there were plans in motion to wage biological warfare against Japanese crops. After the fall of the Reich, the staff of the Chemical Warfare Service began interrogating Hitler's biological weapons makers, many of whom were interned at Dustbin. The Chemical Warfare Service saw enormous potential in making the Nazis' biological weapons program its own and sought any scientific intelligence it could get. The man most wanted in this effort was Hitler's top biological weapons expert, Dr. Kurt Blome. On June 29, 1945, Blome was sent to Dustbin. The officers assigned to interrogate him were Bill Cromarty and J.M. Barnes of Operation Alsace. Each man was uniquely familiar with Blome's background. Cromarty had been in Dr. Eugen Hagen's apartment in Strasbourg in 1944 when he and Alsace scientific director Samuel Goudsmit made the awful discovery that the Reich had been experimenting on people during the war. Blohme was named in the Hagen files. And it was Cromarty and Barnes who led the investigation of the Gerberg facility, the abandoned, curious-looking research outpost hidden in the Thuringian forest. Both Cromarty and Barnes had concluded that Gerberg had been a laboratory for Reich biological weapons research and that Dr. Blohme was in charge. During his initial interview at Dustbin, Blohme refused to cooperate. When he was first interrogated, he was very evasive, Cromarty and Barnes wrote. But a few days later, when interrogated in more detail, Blohme's attitude changed completely and he seemed anxious to give a full account not only of what he actually did, but what he had in mind for future work. Cromarty and Barnes were unsure if they should be enthused by Blohme's seeming change of heart or suspicious of it. Blohme had been observed in the dustbin eating hall conversing at length with Dr. Heinrich Kleve, the Reich's counterintelligence agent for bacterial warfare concerns. Perhaps the two men were concocting a misinformation scheme. During the war, Dr. Kleve's job had been to monitor bioweapons progress being made by Germany's enemies, most notably Russia. Kleve claims that he himself did all the evaluating of the reports received and determined what course of action his department should thenceforth follow, investigators wrote in Kleve's dustbin dossier. Kleve told Blohme that he would likely be taken to Heidelberg for a lengthy interrogation with Alsace agents, as Kleve had been. If Cromarty and Barnes were surprised by Blohme's sudden willingness to talk, they were also aware that most of what he told them could not be independently verified. It is quite impossible to check many of his statements, and what follows is an account of what he related, read a note in Blohme's dustbin dossier. What Blohme recounted was a dark tale of plans for biological warfare spearheaded by Heinrich Himmler. Himmler had a layman's fascination with biological warfare. A former chicken farmer, the Reichsfuhrer SS had studied agriculture in school. According to Blohme, it was Himmler who was the primary motivator behind the Reich's bioweapons program. Hitler, Blohme said, did not approve of biological warfare and was kept in the dark as to specific plans. Himmler's area of greatest fascination, said Blohme, was bubonic plague. On April 30, 1943, Göring had created the cancer research post that was to be held by Blohme. Over the next 19 months, Blohme explained, he met with Himmler 5 times. At their first meeting, which occurred in the summer of 1943, Blohme recalled it as being July or August, Himmler ordered Blohme to study various dissemination methods of plague bacteria for offensive warfare. According to Blohme, he shared with Himmler his fears regarding the dangerous boomerang effect a plague bomb would most likely have on Germany. Himmler told Blohme that in that case, he should get to work immediately to produce a vaccine to prevent such a thing. To expedite vaccine research, Blohme said, Himmler ordered him to use human beings. Himmler offered Blohme a medical block at a concentration camp like Dachau, where he could complete this work. Blohme said he told Himmler he was aware of strong objections in certain circles to using humans in experimental vaccine trials. Himmler told Blohme that experimenting on humans was necessary in the war effort. To refuse was the equivalent of treason. Very well, said Blohme. He considered himself a loyal Nazi, and it was his intention to help Germany win the war. History gives us examples of human disease affecting the outcome of wars, Blohme told his Alsace interrogators, taking a moment to lecture them on history. We know that from antiquity up till the time of the Napoleonic Wars, victories and defeats were often determined by epidemics and starvation, Bloma said. Spreading an infectious disease could bring about the demise of a marauding army, and Bloma said that the failure of Napoleon's Russian campaign was due in great part to the infection of his horses with glanders, a highly contagious bacterial disease. History aside, Bloma said he counseled Himmler on the fact that a concentration camp was a terrible place to experiment with bubonic plague because the population was too dense. Bloma then told Himmler that if he were to experiment with plague bacterium, he would need his own institute, an isolated facility far removed from population centers. Himmler and Bloma agreed that Poland would be a good place, and they settled on Nesselstedt, a small town outside the former Poznan University, by then operated by the Reich. Bloma's research institute was to be called the Bacteriological Institute at Nesselstedt. In the interim, in Berlin, Bloma oversaw a field test using rats, history's traditional carrier of bubonic plague. A debate had been taking place inside the Hygiene Institute of the Waffen-SS as to whether or not rats were the best plague carriers. Himmler's idea was to take infected rats onto U-boats and release them near the enemy shores so they could swim to land. Bloma doubted that rats could swim great distances. He believed they could swim only for as long as the air in their fur kept them afloat. To prove his point, Bloma arranged for a test on a Berlin lake. About 30 rats were taken out in a police boat and released at different distances from the shore to swim both with and against the wind. Bloma said that the rats were dumber than he thought, that when placed in the water, they had no idea where the shore was and swam around in different directions. A few of them drowned in 10 minutes. The longest any of the rats swam for was 30 minutes. Of those released a little over a half mile from shore, only a third reached land. As far as Bloma was concerned, Himmler's U-boat dispersal idea was not practical. Meeting number 2 took place a month or two later, in September or October 1943, and was largely a repetition of the first, at least according to Bloma. There was one significant development, however. Himmler asked Bloma if he needed an assistant. Bloma agreed that a bacteriologist would be helpful. Himmler assigned Dr. Karl Gross, formerly a staff member at the Waffen-SS Hygiene Institute. The two doctors did not get along. Bloma became convinced that Dr. Gross had been sent by Himmler to spy on him. He told his interrogators that he was under great pressure to work faster. Himmler repeatedly reiterated that the methods of waging BW, biological warfare, must be studied in order to understand the defense against it. What this meant was that Himmler wanted Bloma to infect human test subjects with plague to see what would happen to them. The third meeting took place 4 or 5 months later, in February 1944. By this time, Bloma said, the facility at Nesselstedt had been built. There was ample staff housing, a well-equipped laboratory, and an animal farm. The block for experimental work included a climate room, a cold room, disinfectant facilities, and rooms for clean and dirty experiments. There was an isolation hospital for 16 people in the event that workers on Bloma's staff contracted the disease. Work progressed slowly, Bloma said, and Himmler became enraged. Rumors of an Allied invasion of the European continent had become a constant thorn in the side of the Reichsfuhrer SS. Why wasn't the Reich's bioweapons program more advanced? Himmler demanded to know. He asked Bloma if it was possible to do something now, for example, disseminate influenza that would delay the heralded Anglo-American invasion in the West. According to Bloma, he told Himmler, it was impossible to do anything on these lines. Himmler proposed another idea. How about disseminating a virulent strain of hoof-and-mouth disease, or tularemia, also called rabbit fever, which affected man in a manner similar to plague? Blume told Himmler that these were dangerous ideas, as any outbreak would surely affect Germany's troops. The Reich needed a massive stockpile of vaccinations before it could feasibly launch a biological attack. Himmler stretched his thinking to target the Allies on their own soil. How about spreading cattle plague, also called Rinderpest, in America or England? Himmler told Blume that infecting the enemy's food supply would have a sinister effect on enemy troops. Blume agreed and said he would investigate what it would take to start a plague epidemic among the enemy's cows. There was, however, a problem, Blume explained. An international agreement prohibited stocks of the Rinderpest virus to be stored anywhere in Europe. Strains of cattle plague were available only in the Third World. Himmler said that he would get the cattle plague himself. He sent Dr. Erich Traub, a veterinarian from the Reich's State Research Institute, located on the island of Reims, to Turkey. There, Dr. Traub acquired a strain of the lethal Rinderpest virus. Under Blume's direction, trials to infect healthy cows with Rinderpest began. Reims, in northern Germany, in the Bay of Greifswald, was totally isolated and self-contained. It was the perfect place for these dangerous tests. The veterinary section used airplanes to spray the cattle plague virus on the island's grassy fields where cows grazed. Blume said he didn't know much more about the program or its results, only that Dr. Traub, second in command at the research facility, was taken by the Russians when the Red Army captured Reims in April 1945. Blume's fourth meeting with Himmler took place in April or May of 1944. Himmler had become paranoid by now, Blume said. He believed that the Allies were plotting a biological weapons attack against the Reich. Blume was summoned by telephone to see Himmler urgently. The latter had received a number of curious reports. Grass had come floating out of the sky over some part of Austria, and a cow that had eaten some of it had died. Blume told Himmler he'd look into it. There were additional strange events, Himmler confided to Blume. Some small balloons had been found near Salzburg and Berchtesgaden, not far from Hitler's mountain residence, the Berghof. And potato beetles had been dropped in Normandy. Blume promised to study each incident. Blume told Himmler he had a pressing issue of his own. Given the progress of the Red Army, he thought it was wise to move his plague research institute at Poznan, somewhere inside Germany. The place Blume suggested was Garaburg, in the Thuringian forest at the edge of the Harz Mountains. Himmler said that the Russians would never reach Posen. By early fall, he had changed his mind. In October, a new biological weapons research facility was being built, concealed inside a pine forest in the village of Garaburg. In the meantime, Blume told his interrogators, work on vaccines was moving forward, not at either of his research institutes, but inside the army instead. Göring had moved epidemic control into the jurisdiction of a major general named Dr. Walter Schreiber, Surgeon General of the Reich. Blume held the position of Deputy Surgeon General of the Reich, but the two men had equal positions under Göring, Blume explained. He, Blume, was in charge of creating the biological weapons. Dr. Schreiber was in charge of protecting Germans against biological weapons, should they be used. Major General Dr. Schreiber specialized in epidemic control. The sword and the shield. Alsace was very interested in learning about these vaccines. Blume said that Major General Dr. Schreiber was the person to talk to about that. Where could he be found? Blume said Schreiber had last been seen in Berlin. Word was he had surrendered to the Red Army and was their prisoner now. Bloma said something else that alarmed interrogators. During the war, Dr. Kleva told Bloma that it was the Russians who had the single most extensive biological weapons program in the world, a program more advanced even than that of the Japanese.